Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman reporting the U.S. president is under fire for his reaction to a race-based confrontation. President Donald Trump is under attack across the U.S. political spectrum for his failure to denounce the white supremacist who staged the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, one that turned deadly. Trump, often quick to comment on terrorist attacks, condemned this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides that resulted in one death and 19 injuries in the midst of the street violence and the deaths of two state police troopers killed in a helicopter crash linked to the rally. In Twitter remarks, he offered condolences for the three who lost their lives and best regards to all of those injured. But Trump did not condemn the extremist groups who organized Saturday's protests, many of them his political supporters, who openly derided racial minorities, Jews, and women with signs and chants. David Duke, a one-time leader of the racist Ku Klux Klan in the United States, said the rally about 160 kilometers southwest of Washington was a turning point for a movement to fulfill the promises of Donald Trump. Today, the White House said that President Trump very strongly condemns individual hate groups such as white supremacists, KKK, and neo-Nazis. A spokeswoman says Trump denounces all forms of violence, bigotry, and hatred. Some Republicans and Democrats are critical of Trump for not specifically singling out the hate groups that sparked the violent protest that rocked Charlottesville. The president had not addressed the matter on Sunday. A White House spokeswoman declined to make the new statement on the record. Former President Barack Obama and Trump's Democratic rival Hillary Clinton both condemned. This is VOA News. The top U.S. general has arrived on the Korean Peninsula amid unprecedented threats between Washington and Pyongyang and his annual military exercises between the United States and South Korea risk further increasing tensions. Speaking to reporters en route to Korea, U.S. General Joe Dumford, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, says the military's primary focus is supporting the administration's diplomatic and economic campaign to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula while preparing military options in the event the campaign fails. He said his visit to the region this week is aimed at reassuring allies, South Korea and Japan, while building the military-to-military relationship with China in order to prevent miscalculations. Dunford said, "We're all looking to get out of this situation without a war." CIA Director Mike Pompeo, appearing on Fox News Sunday, was asked if North Korea might soon continue its missile testing program.
"I'm quite confident that he will continue to try to develop his missile program, so it wouldn't surprise me if there was another missile test. He conducted two in July, so it wouldn't surprise me if there was another missile test."
North Korean state media announced the country was drawing up plans to fire missiles near the U.S. Pacific territory of Guam, and the U.S. military continued preparations for a potential military excuse. In Guam, many attended Sunday church services to pray for their safety. Mike Chrysostomo is the pastor of the Immaculate Heart of Mary.
"Obviously, what's happening within our region of the world, the threats of a nuclear attack and nuclear missile strike. And so we are here to pray to ward that out and to be able to pray for the leaders of those countries to be able to remain calm and to think about the people and the lives of the people that we have here."
The Venezuelan government has responded to U.S. President Trump, who included the military option as a possible action during his remarks on the rapidly devolving socialist country. Saturday, Venezuela's foreign minister, Jorge Arreaza, condemned U.S. threats against his crisis-hit nation, saying the warmongering declarations from President Trump clearly framed in the systemic aggregations of the U.S. administration against Venezuela represent a direct threat against peace, stability, independence, territorial unity, sovereignty, and the right of self-determination. I'm Ira Melman.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
I think that Kenyans generally would not like to get involved in any violence. And the best I can do is to advise my brother, my friend, that he probably would consider conceding.
The Kenyan main opposition leader, Raila Odinga, urges supporters to stay away from work on Monday.
The treason case is coming up on Monday for the United Party for National Development leader, Hakainde Hichilema, in Zambia. Everybody is anxious waiting for that court case.
The treason trial of the Zambian main opposition leader Hakainde Hichilema begins Monday.
The deputy president of the Republic of South Africa, Mr. Cyril Ramaphosa, indicated that Lesotho, and I quote him verbatim, "We are tired of being the bad boys of SADC."
And the Prime Minister of the Kingdom of Lesotho says he is ready for a national dialogue with all stakeholders. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Raila Odinga, the leader of the Kenyan main opposition National Super Alliance, or NASA, has called on supporters of the party to boycott work on Monday. The former prime minister rejected the outcome of the presidential vote, saying it was rigged. The Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, or IEBC, declared incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta winner of the presidential poll with 54% of the vote, while Odinga garnered 44% of the total vote cast. Local and international poll monitors say the elections were credible, but Odinga expressed displeasure with the vote as Kenyans say his call could increase tension. For reaction to Raila Odinga's call to boycott work on Monday, I reached Senator David Musila in the capital, Nairobi.
First of all, I sympathize with the Honorable Raila Odinga having lost his election and this not being the first one to lose. However, I think that Kenyans generally would not like to get involved in any violence. And the best I can do is to advise my brother, my friend, that he probably would consider conceding if he does not wish to pursue the legal option. Because if I was to advise, I would have asked him to pursue legal option, file a petition in the Supreme Court, and let's wait for the decision. But I do understand that he has said that that's not an option. So I do not think that the route of violence or demonstrations will bear any fruit.
Some people are expressing concern that his call for his supporters not to go to work on Monday could increase tension existing already in the country following the outcome of the elections. What are you hearing?
That call for people not to go to work could incite the population. But the general feeling of the population, particularly from my community where I come from, which was in the coalition, is that violence will not be an option, and therefore they will not support.
What is the mood in the country at the moment?
Well, people are going about their businesses. I've just come from church, and churches are packed. People have gone to worship. There is call for peace by the clergy. I'm not seeing anything in Nairobi. Nairobi is quiet. Nairobi is calm. Other than those spots of you have heard about, and where I am sitting now, I only, in fact, rely more on foreign media because we are not seeing anything much. But having said that, I still believe that this country needs peace. And I think people are tired of violence. And in my own capacity, I can just appeal to people not to be violent and also to the loser or perceived loser, if you will. But he is a loser because the body that is charged with the responsibility of determining the winner and the loser has already pronounced their position. And the only option is going to court. And therefore, the mood is such that people want the legal option rather than violence.
David Musila is a Kenyan senator. He spoke with me from Nairobi. The leader of Zambian main opposition party, the United Party for National Development, or UPND, goes on trial Monday. Hakainde Hichilema is in maximum security prison as he awaits trial for treason charges after his convoy refused to give way to President Lungu's motorcade earlier this year. Hichilema has so far refused to accept the victory of President Lungu in the last presidential election. But Charles Kakoma, spokesman for the main opposition party, the UPND, says charges against Hichilema are politically motivated, adding that it stems from the decision of the party not to recognize President Lungu as the legitimate Zambian president.
The treason case is coming up on Monday for the United Party for National Development leader Hakainde Hichilema in Zambia. Everybody is anxious waiting for that court case, but we have just received the instructions from the judiciary imposing restrictions on who should attend and who should not. For example, there were banned the members of the public from going to attend the court case. And there are also restrictions even on the media. Many of the journalists have been denied their accreditation to cover the event, including international media who have already attempted to get accreditation and they've been denied.
What does this mean for supporters and colleagues of UPND leader Hakainde Hichilema with the court restrictions even on the media?
Well, we don't know why the government is worried about this case, why they're posing those restrictions, but it appears they are panicking. They don't know how to handle the public and the media. But by law, this case is coming up in open court, and any member of the public or the media are free to cover a matter that is open court. So it is unfortunate and unprecedented in the Zambian history that people can be denied their right to attend an open court hearing.
A lot of your UPND colleagues went to visit him, including the expelled Patriotic Front Member of Parliament, Chisemba Kambuili. How is the UPND leader Hakainde Hichilema doing at the moment while in prison? How is he?
Well, he's in high spirits. Those who visited him are reporting that he's in high spirits and looking forward to Monday. He's, in fact, encouraging those that are visiting him to be stronger and not to worry about him because he's okay. So we're getting relief from such reports.
International figures who have called for dialogue between Hakainde Hichilema, President Edgar Lungu, civil society and other stakeholders in the country. Is Hakainde Hichilema in favor of holding dialogue with President Edgar Chagwa Lungu?
Yes, President Hakainde Hichilema is ready for dialogue. He has been calling for dialogue himself because many of the issues that wanted to be resolved in this country, including some issues that were originally in the petition, which we wanted to resolve through the court, can still be resolved through dialogue. For example, issues to do with the police brutality, issues to do with the restrictions on people's freedoms and rights, including control of assemblies under the Preservation of under the Public Order Act. All those things can still be resolved through dialogue.
I'm talking about dialogue without preconditions.
Well, the best dialogue is always without conditions. A dialogue that comes with conditions is always very difficult to proceed with. So we would like that if this dialogue is to make progress quickly, conditions must be dropped.
What are your expectations on Monday as the treason trial reopens in Lusaka?
Well, we're expecting that, of course, Akahinde Hichilema should be released because there's no need for the state to continue holding him. In our view, that prison charge is trumped up and there's no need to continue holding him. It is creating unnecessary tension in this country. Releasing him is a step towards maintaining unity and peace in our country.
Charles Kakoma is the spokesman for the Zambian main opposition party, the United Party for National Development, or UPND. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. The Prime Minister of the Kingdom of Lesotho says he is ready for a national dialogue to help bring lasting peace and stability. Tom Tabani says there's need to resolve tension in the country. His remarks came after South African Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa went to Lesotho to assess the situation in the kingdom. The South African Deputy President is mediator for the regional bloc to help with dialogue between the government, opposition and civil society groups to end the country's instability. The anticipated talks are aimed to create a framework for implementing security, constitutional, media and public service reform. For more, I reach Thabo Takwalekwala, a spokesman for the Prime Minister of Lesotho, Tom Tabani.
The Prime Minister of the Kingdom of Lesotho, Dr. Mutwahae Thomas Tabani, has, during the visit of the SADC facilitator to Lesotho, who is also the Deputy President of the Republic of South Africa, Mr. Cyril Ramaphosa, indicated that Lesotho, and I quote him verbatim, "We are tired of being the bad boys of SADC. SADC is not our children. SADC are our friends. And we should do what SADC tells us to do. We'll definitely implement whatever SADC says the Lesotho should do." End of quote.
Now, how soon do you think this national dialogue will take place? Because invariably it appears that Cyril Ramaphosa wants the help or input from the African Union as well as the rest of the international community.
What is going to happen right now is that now that he has met all the stakeholders in Lesotho, Mr. Ramaphosa is going to present his report about his consultations in Lesotho to the Double Troika Summit on the 18th and 19th of this month in Pretoria, South Africa. He will also report to the 37th SADC Heads of State and Government Summit that will be held on the 18th and 19th of August in Pretoria, South Africa. Now, after giving a report to SADC, SADC will give direction as to how and when the national dialogue will be held. And African Union and the United Nations are also expected to assist in making sure that this national dialogue becomes a resounding success.
The Prime Minister promised during the election campaign that he was going to ensure security sector reform, which is often blamed for the political and sometimes security tension in the country. When does he intend to do this, and when does an investigation into the murder of a former lieutenant general going to play in this effort to ensure the Kingdom of Lesotho maintain peace and stability?
What you are talking about is part and parcel of what Mr. Ramaphosa came here about. It's part of the reform process. The reform process includes reforms of the security establishment in this country, reform of the parliament, reform of the judicial service, reform of the public service, etc., etc. Now, the issue of the slain former commander of the Lesotho Defense Force and the issue of the soldiers that are still in exile in South Africa are included in the report that Mr. Ramaphosa is going to give to SADC. And I'm not at liberty to divulge details about that. So we are expecting that SADC, after tabling of the report by Mr. Ramaphosa about all these issues, including the reform process, SADC will make a definite decision on the way forward as far as the reform process in Lesotho is concerned.
What was the assessment of Deputy South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, who has been mandated by the regional bloc SADC to mediate in the possible dialogue in the Kingdom of Lesotho?
The assessment of Deputy President and facilitator Mr. Ramaphosa was very positive. Actually, he expressed a sentiment that he hopes, and indeed SADC hopes, that now Lesotho will have a stable government, Lesotho will have peace, and he urged the leaders of Lesotho to work closely together to make sure that we don't go for elections after a period of 2 years or 2.5 years. He expressed hope that the incumbent government will be in power for the next 5 years, and Basotho will enjoy the fruits, will enjoy the warmth of this government.
Tabo Takwalekwala is the spokesman for the Prime Minister of Lesotho, Tom Tabani. He spoke with me from the capital, Maseru. Fighting flared this week in the South Sudanese's Upper Nile State after government forces captured a key rebel headquarters. The ongoing clashes indicate there's no end in sight to the four-year conflict. For VOA, Jason Patinkin speaks to both sides in the war and a civilian court in between.
South Sudan's government and rebels clashed Friday in the northeastern state of Upper Nile over control of the key town of Pagak on the Ethiopian border. Pagak had been the rebels' main base since early 2014, but the government captured the town last week after launching an offensive in early July. Rebel spokesman Lam Paul Gabriel said his side took back the town Friday after a morning attack on government troops.
At about 7, we launched an attack on government in Pagak. And we deployed them from Pagak. So we are full control of Pagak since about 10 a.m.
The government's original capture of Pagak was a devastating blow for the rebels, who had controlled the border town since South Sudan's civil war started in December 2013. The fact that the rebels are still able to fight back shows the conflict is far from over. The insurgency maintains control of much of the country's rural areas, while the government holds major towns.
It's a clear sign that if we are pushed to a corner, we will also push back. They took Pagak from us, now we took it back. It's the same with any other places now. We are strong.
A spokesman for government forces, Dixon Gatluak, confirmed there was fighting in Pagak, but he denied that the rebels took control of the town.
In the morning, our defensive line came under heavy fire from anti-peace elements. We actually engaged them, and after a fierce battle, our forces managed to strike back and self-defend, and we repelled them. We are still maintaining our defensive line. The claim that they are doing, that they have captured Pagak and all this, is not true.
The government's offensive on Pagak drew heavy criticism from Western nations for breaking a ceasefire declared in May by President Salva Kiir, whose forces are fighting rebels led by former Vice President Riek Machar. But Gatluak said the offensive was necessary to bring government services to the people. He said civilians had welcomed the arrival of government troops.
Civilians in Pagak have been held hostage for almost 4 years in the conflict in Iraq, so it was a call for the government to be on the ground to provide the services.
But according to South Sudanese aid worker Sarah Nyanyath, who was living in Pagak, tens of thousands of civilians, including herself, fled the government's offensive into Ethiopia rather than welcoming them.
The government is lying that it is being received. They are not liberating the area. They are terrorizing the area.
Nyanyath, speaking from Ethiopia, where she is now a refugee, said two children drowned while fleeing across a river to Ethiopia. She described what it was like to watch as the army shelled the area.
The sound is terrible. You know, they were being hit in the night. You can see actually what some of these rockets are opening up. You could see the lights, okay? The light when the thing is buffering out. When it hit the ground, it's actually shook the ground. You can see the ground vibrating, you know? It is so scary.
As South Sudan's war churns on, it is likely that even more civilians like Nyanyath will be forced to run. Jason Patinkin for VOA News in Koboko, Uganda.
And in New York, the state is one of the most ethnically diverse cities in the world, and each immigrant group offers it its own unique music, dance, theater, and other artistic traditions. Recently, leaders from dozens of these groups created the Immigrant Arts Coalition, or IAC. The IAC will allow immigrant art organizations to share resources and to showcase their multicultural talent. VOA's Adam Phillips attended a concert celebrating the birth of the league and filed this report.
It's twilight on a perfect summer evening in Battery Park on the banks of the Hudson River in Lower Manhattan. And the America, the Golden Land Band kicks things off with a Jewish klezmer melody. Behind the band, perhaps a kilometer away, the Statue of Liberty serenely watches over New York Harbor. This is deeply meaningful to the audience here. Many are first or second generation immigrants. Most are painfully aware of the anti-immigrant sentiments currently at play in much of the United States. All seemed heartened by the creation today of the Immigrant Arts Coalition, which this concert celebrates.
So Zeltan and Gelegenheit, an opportunity of a lifetime.
Watch your step, strike my voice and scream. Watch your step, you know I can't get the same.
The entertainment begins with Watch Your Step, the opening production number from America, the Golden Land. It's the hit musical now showing nearby at the National Yiddish Theater, Volksbühne. The Volksbühne is a key organizer of the Immigrant Arts Coalition. Sung in both English and Yiddish, Watch Your Step conveys the struggle, the frenzy, and the promise of immigrant life a century ago. Volksbühne producer Christopher Massamine says many of today's immigrants have the same experience as those immigrants did.
And their art is our art, because at the end of the day, we all come from immigrant backgrounds. We all come from diverse backgrounds from this country. It's a strength, and that's what this is all about. The colors of the rainbow are separate and diverse, but they work together to create something beautiful.
To pick just a few sample colors from tonight's rainbow, there is modern dance with Turkish roots performed by the Turkish American Repertory Theater and Entertainment Company. Then there's a Russian folk dance performed by children with kaleidoscope, wearing festive red costumes. For spoken word, Soledad Ensemble's The Seven Ravens Project combines an old Grimm Brothers story from Germany about a young girl's quest to find her lost long brothers with true, tragic, and triumphant tales of child migrants today.
In the weeks leading up to her 12th birthday, the little girl began having strange dreams in which she was haunted by the vision of seven dark figures. Sometimes the figures came to her as large, dark birds, sometimes in the shape of boys.
Northern Europe gives way to West Africa as Vado Diamande of the Kuchenga Dance Company performs traditional dance and drumming from his native Ivory Coast.
I come to New York to show the world African traditional dance from Ivory Coast. African dance makes you happy. I dream about it.
Jahano Young is dancing with Diamande tonight. She says that as an African-American, Ivory Coast's complex, high-energy rhythms connect her to her family's ancient roots in the continent.
And I'm really glad for these ambassadors from Africa that are sharing and contributing their actual history with Black people in America. That's what truly makes America great. So we're just here to represent a piece of that and to share a piece of that.
This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island.
So what better song to round out the Immigrants' Art Concerts than with This Land is Your Land? Almost every American knows the classic patriotic protest song Woody Guthrie penned back in 1940. Guthrie was a tireless political activist for workers, migrants, and all the downtrodden. David Lutgun, who plays the Guthrie character in Woody Says, his show at the Irish Repertory Company, sings it here.
Of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people.
He says that Guthrie always championed tolerance, inclusion, and celebration as essential American values. He added that, then as now, respecting immigrants, their heritage, and their gifts is key to the nation's success and happiness. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In football, Morocco has confirmed it will bid to host the World Cup 2026. FIFA confirmed it received an expression of interest in bidding to host the tournament from Morocco Football Federation by Friday's deadline. U.S., Canada, and Mexico had already announced in April that they intend to forward a joint bid. The World Cup has only been hosted once in Africa, in South Africa in 2010, and this will be Morocco's fifth bid. CAF gave its backing to a Moroccan bid last month. A total of 48 teams, rather than the current 32, will compete at the expanded tournament in 2026 after changes announced by FIFA earlier this year. A decision on who will host the event will be made in 2020. FIFA's rotational hosting policy means Africa is one of four confederations that can bid to host the 2026 finals, as Europe, Russia 2010, and Asia, Qatar 2022, cannot be considered. Still in African football, 10-team Bafana Bafana succumbed to a late goal as Zambia came from behind to draw the first leg of their CHAN qualifier 2-2 at the Buffalo City Stadium Saturday. Gift Mutopa scored in the first half, and Mario Boysen a second after the break before Martin Firi pulled one back. As Terence Malepe was sent off, Zambia took advantage and scored through Justin Shonga. In other CHAN qualifiers, Uganda beat Rwanda 3-0 in Kampala. Sao Tome drew with Cameroon 0-0, while Burkina Faso held Ghana to a 2-2 draw, and Mauritania drew with Mali 2-2. And in athletics, at the World Championships in London, Britain's Mo Farah failed to claim 5,000 meters gold as Mukhta Idris came first. Farah was unable to claim his 11th World Championship title to add to his 10,000 meter success, as he was forced to settle for silver in his last championship appearance before he switches to the marathon. He had been expected to win his 11th major title by completing a world championship double following his thrilling win in the 10,000 meters 8 days ago. The 34-year-old is hanging up his spikes to take to the roads in the marathon after a stellar career which has seen him establish himself as one of the all-time greats of sports. Until London 2017, and not since the 10,000 meters World Championships in Daegu in 2011, had anyone managed to beat the brilliant Londoner in a major final. Also, Great Britain's men claimed a stunning 4x100 meters relay gold as Usain Bolt pulled up injured in his final race. Never before has a British team won a world sprint gold, but this time they ran a near-perfect race to hold off the fancied US team, with Japan taking bronze as Bolt collapsed with a muscle cramp halfway down the home stretch. Bolt leaves his final championship with only a bronze from the individual 100-meter race. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Plenty people don't they ask. Now we see Baba do the jazz. Shady Baba do well for me. Now my life is done better. Not because I suffer fast. Not because I pray and fast. No be your show, no be jazz. I'm watching. My humble father, Sinachi. My loving daughter, Sinachi mo. My baby mama, Sinachi. Tele momo do, Sinachi mo. No be by force to go Dubai. I've been awaiting cause the fight. And I just did my own, they laugh, yeah, because it got the day my side. They want to take away my favor. They want to spoil in my career. And I know say I get the flavor. And you feel taxing na banya. I forgive and I forget. Baba God, he knows the best. My papa just buy you jet. I'm about to take off everywhere.
Hey, what's in that I'm no qua. What's in that my name, man. What's in that I'm watching.
I go name my first daughter, Sinachi. My loving mother, Sinachuku. Promotion letter, Sinachi. Iyawomi, Sinachi. Now we shutting down Malaysia. Every show, the boy, they conquer. Thank you, Lord, you showed me love. Now I know I'm not alone. I go sing praises from house to church. I go throw party for every town. See my motto, see my mouth. Tell me why I no go shout. Not because I suffer fast. Not because I pray and fast. Not be your show, not be just. Up my chin. Hey, what's in that chin? I'm no qua. What's in that chin? One name, man. What's in that chin? Up my chin. Hey, what's in that chin? Mama. What's in that chin? Gotta be fair. What's in that chin? Up my chin. And I thank the Lord who oversee me. And I thank the Lord for humble smith. And I thank the Lord who give me power. Oh, and I thank the Lord for all the riches. And they pray for house, you give me mansion. And they pray for car, you give me phantom. And they pray for fans, you give me stardom. Oh, you they show me love, you know, be like.
Jibo Kwezwenu, Ndinji Biri. Ije my family, Sinachuku. If no be God, where I forget. Forever we go give God the glory. We they travel, they go, they come. Everything we do, they prosper. Because your name not favor, I'll spend it as a pleasure. Let the people join the ask. Now with the Baba do the task. Baba do well for me. Now my life is done better. Not because I suffer fast. Not because I pray and fast. No be your show, no be just. I'm watching. Tell it, what's in that cheek? I'm no qua, what's in that cheek? One name, man, what's in that cheek? I'm watching.
Yeah.
Oh, Zini, O Cherry Bats, Sandini, O Hata Bats, Yegini, Ubano Gazmiga.
Gebas ya tandan, ya lubas tandan isilale madunge. Ndibanjwangue, ya lubas tandan isilale madunge. Nguwe lo, ya lubas tandan isilale madunge. Denzi wangue. Ya luba standa nisilale matunge Pazali babu Ndibize enu na mfula wa Tetani naje Itani imbileta Pazali babu Ndibize enu sitandwa saa Itani guso, itani imbileta wena. Sitandwa sabu, zalaishi mote masimi ni zalaisha. Bogo ndilindile, zalaishi mote masimi ni zalaisha. Sitandwa sabu. Zalaishi mote masimi ni zalaisha Agavelu nombula wa Zalaisha Naishi mote masimi nizalaisha Ndibanga chumela badula ngendi Au penduli no mvulawa
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of The Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Hopefully, a large number of Africans followed closely the drama of the no-confidence vote in South African Parliament last week. That was the eighth attempt by the three opposition parties in Parliament to oust President Jacob Zuma in the no-confidence vote. What was surprising is the coverage leading to that vote. The opposition towards Jacob Zuma, both locally and internationally, was overwhelming. And because analysts were not dispassionate in the analysis, they made many mistakes. The first mistake was to assume that President Jacob Zuma would not recover from a secret ballot in Parliament. The second is to misjudge the division within the ANC, the African National Congress. That division is not solely related to antipathy towards President Jacob Zuma. It relates mainly to the forthcoming contest this December for the leadership of the ANC, where you have three major contestants. And those who do not support the candidate of President Zuma, which is his former wife, Dr. Zuma, who recently left as the head of the African Union, they are all ill against him. And the ANC leadership judged that they would lose the no-confidence vote in a secret ballot. You could be sure that they would have challenged the ruling of the Speaker in Parliament, and that could have been resolved in an open vote, and the ANC would have prevailed. The fact that they did not challenge that ruling meant that they had done their own calculation and came to the conclusion that President Zuma would be able to prevail even though there might be some defection, which is precisely what happened in the votes. One commentator was so giddy about President Zuma losing that he made the ridiculous prediction that once President Zuma had been defeated in the no-confidence vote, the entire government would resign and a new government would emerge led by the DA, the Democratic Alliance, in alliance with the Economic Freedom Fighters of Julius Malema. That was no way this could have happened. And the fact is that the South African people understand the history. No one is denying that there is no corruption within the ANC, not even that Jacob Zuma himself may be guilty of corruption, or that the Gupta brothers are playing corrupt things. That's not the issue. The issue is that there has been a long-drawn battle inside South Africa with their supporters out to weaken the ANC. There have been previous defections from the ANC. None of them have prospered except one, which is Malema's Economic Freedom Fighters. And that's the situation. One does not hope to see a resolution of this issue until we have a new leadership in the ANC, which will be done in December, and then President Zuma may or may not serve out the rest of his term in 2018. This is the situation. Now is the time for the opposition parties in Parliament to forgo their efforts to topple the ANC in a parliamentary contest. They must now devote their attention to legislation. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Tiang Wang, we say thanks for joining us. I remember, as the elders say, he who led me in the night will be thanked by me at daybreak. I'm your host, Peter Clotin in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States congratulates the people of Rwanda on their active and peaceful participation in the presidential election held August 4th. More than 6.6 million Rwandans cast ballots for Mr. Kagame, according to the official tally, though this number appears inflated. Just over 80,000 voted for the opposition. The government claimed turnout totaled 97.6%. But the electoral process fell short of democratic standards. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert said, "We are disturbed by irregularities observed during voting and reiterate longstanding concerns over the integrity of the vote tabulation process." The United States commends the Rwandan media for reporting on complaints of harassment of some opposition candidates and Rwandan citizens during the campaign. The U.S. also commends average citizens, the National Electoral Commission, and government officials for speaking out and addressing those complaints. Spokesperson Nauert added, "We applaud the televised presidential debate," while noting that voters' understanding would have benefited from broader participation of the candidates themselves. The U.S. remains concerned by the lack of transparency in determining the eligibility of prospective candidates. It is hoped the new electoral law to be debated in the next session of Parliament will clarify that process well before the 2018 parliamentary elections. Rwandan President Kagame has led the country of 12 million people since his rebels helped to end the 1994 genocide, in which more than 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus were massacred by Hutu extremists. Under President Kagame, Rwanda has made great economic strides, but his critics say this has come at the expense of civil liberties and media freedoms. Human rights groups report that his government has used state powers to silence the opposition through systematic repression. A constitutional amendment in 2015 allows Mr. Kagame to stay in power until 2034 if he pursues it. The United States expressed disappointment with the change to the Constitution and Kagame's decision to seek a third term. The United States encourages the government of Rwanda to foster an environment where civil society and all political parties can participate in elections without intimidation and elections truly reflect the will of the people. The United States stands by the people of Rwanda in their efforts to build strong, democratic, and inclusive institutions in order to ensure long-term stability and a democratic, prosperous future for all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.